It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new federal report raises questions about the quality of hospice care in the United States. We'll find out what things look like here in Wisconsin. Now,
T-minus 10, 9, 8. We have a go for main engine start. We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
That was liftoff, and 50 years ago this weekend, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong became the first humans to set foot on the moon. It was a big moment for the country and the world. But our next guest says the story of how it actually came to be was more complicated than the one we often hear today, and that we need to understand that to understand the program's full legacy. Roger Lanius is a former chief historian at NASA. He's also former associate director of collections and curatorial affairs at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. His new book is called Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. Roger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Your book tells the story of the moon landing, but also the story of how we remember the moon landing. Why is it important to look back on the different stories we tell about the moon landing?
Yeah, you know, the moon landing has all of these sort of meaningful elements to it. And most of us, when we think back on it today, we view it as this unadulterated triumph, that we, as a nation, rallied behind a president's desire to go to the moon. We made it happen, and we all celebrate that as a great victory. And there's clearly a lot of truth to that, and we can certainly use it as an exemplar of our American capabilities and our exceptionalism as a nation. But it's more than that as well, and we need to remember the other pieces to it.
Looking back at the politics of the moon effort, I mean, this is like anything we look at in politics today. There was political fighting over the budget. There was bureaucratic fighting over this. It was politics as usual in the United States in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely. Again, we sort of see it as this great marching triumph, but the political processes to get there were very difficult. There were people literally on both sides of the political aisle who objected to it. They thought the money could be spent in other ways, different ways depending on your political leanings, but nonetheless in different ways. And it was never a foregone conclusion. It was going to turn out the way it did.
I want to listen to President John F. Kennedy's famous moon speech at Rice University in Texas. This is in 1962.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
You know, listening to when they applauded there, it sounds like they were applauding the Rice-Texas football game as much as the moon. But can you talk about, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that John F. Kennedy was going to make this push for the space program. Can you talk about what was going on in his administration that led up to this kind of speech?
Oh, absolutely. So in the spring of 1961, I mean, you've got a young new president who's just taken office in January of that particular year. And he's had a whole series of setbacks all through the spring. And two of them really sort of come to a head near the same time in April, the 12th of April, when Yuri Gagarin flies around the world, a Soviet cosmonaut, the first person in space, and he becomes an overnight sensation. He becomes a celebrity worldwide. And, of course, the Soviet Union uses this as an example of how the Russian model, the Marxist model, is the way in which the future is going to be defined, and this is a great thing. And within a week of that, Kennedy faces a setback when his CIA-backed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba fails to overthrow Castro. And so you've got a Soviet success coupled with a very public American failure. And Kennedy decides at that point, I've got to do something to sort of change the subject, to regain the momentum moving forward. And it's that point in which he just says, okay, what can I do? Let's do it in space. And what can I do that will beat the Russians at? And we have to understand that larger Cold War context as critical to this.
But a big what if that I didn't know about till I read your book, there were a couple of approaches to say, hey, what if this was a joint operation? U.S., Soviet Union, we right. work together to get to the moon.
Yeah, no, there was all kinds of opportunities, and they could have pursued those and may well have had Kennedy's assassination not taken place in the fall of 1963. But within a few days after announcing the Apollo program in May of 1961, he's already starting to have second thoughts. And he does propose to Khrushchev in their one and only summit meeting in June of that year, you know, maybe we could turn this into a joint effort. And Khrushchev's response was sort of noncommittal and nothing came of it. But after a very tumultuous fall of 1961 and into 62, but after the Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of 62, when tensions lessen a little bit, Kennedy revisits the idea and comes back to it. And that was clearly on his mind in the fall of 1963, not long before his assassination.
Talking to Roger Lanius, former chief historian at NASA. His new book is Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. Roger, attention all through the mission, the landing itself, and in the way people talk about it is, was this a great American achievement or was this a great human achievement? And it's a little of both, it seems like.
Absolutely it is. Obviously, this is an American activity, and Americans took great pride in the fact that they were able to accomplish this. But if you were not an American and you're watching this from name the nation of your choice, you could be quite proud of the fact that humanity had now done this. These were not just representatives of the United States. They were representatives of all humankind. And it sort of gets said that way when the astronauts reach the moon in 1969. They do raise the American flag, of course, and it's the only flag that is raised on the moon. But they also say we came in peace for all mankind. And that includes everybody, and we could all feel good about that, regardless of where you're from.
And you write that it wasn't live televised in the Soviet Union, but the Soviet media did treat the American astronauts as celebrities in some ways and kind of celebrated this, even with all the animosity.
Oh, no question about that. I mean, the Cold War is a very real issue all through this time frame, but literally around the world, regardless of where you were, on which side of the Cold War you might have been, or in a you know in a democratic nation or one that was totalitarian, there is genuinely a larger perspective where people pay attention and they are excited and proud of this achievement.
On the one hand, as you say, the astronauts in the space program represented all humanity, but you say even at the time there are questions about whether they even represented the United States. It was a very particular category of person who went into the space program.
Yeah, no question about that, too. I mean, these were all white males. Most of them, and they were not unlike a lot of white males of the time period, most of them came out of a middle class or maybe even a lower middle class background. They're often the first generation in their family to attend college. Most of the time they're educated in either a state university in a technical program of some kind or at one of the military service academies. And in that sense, they do not come into this with a sort of an elite approach to things. And they're very much our avatars as we undertake these moon missions. They represent a lot of what we think about ourselves as being good and decent, middle class, and so forth. But they did not include any women. They did not include any minorities. And that was a failing on the part of NASA and the larger efforts of the time frame. It would not be until the 1970s when the first minority and women astronauts were selected at NASA.
Talking to Roger Lanius, formerly of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum and former chief historian at NASA, talking about his new book, Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were there watching on TV, tell us about your memory of the moon landing. How did you feel when you watched it? What did people talk about at the time? What do you think about the achievement now, 50 years later? If you were, like me, born after the moon landing, how do you look back on it? What were the stories you heard? What does it mean for the United States, for the world? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation about the Apollo space program and the moon landing that celebrates its 50th anniversary this weekend. Roger Lanius is with us, former chief historian at NASA. He's the author of Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were around at the time, if you were watching, what do you remember? What did you think of this? A unique moment in human history. Is it worth it to do it again? Should we have another moonshot effort to get to the moon, to Mars, or as a metaphor to do something else? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Menominee Falls. Lisa, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to share with you my experience with the Apollo moon mission. So I was a very young girl, and I was asleep, actually. And I think I was still in a onesie with the feet. Gives you an idea of what time frame we're looking at here. But I remember my mother waking me up, and I didn't want to be woken up. And she said, no, this is really important. And I remember thinking, wow, I don't think my mother's ever said those words to me. So I shook myself awake and paddled down the hallway. And my siblings were around. We have this big Magnavox floor model TV, very advanced for the time, one with the carved wood and all. And they let me sit right in front, cross-legged on the floor in my little footy pajamas. I remember watching, and when Armstrong's foot hit the moon, I remember we all just cheered, and everybody laughed a little bit, and we clapped. And I remember, because we were watching in the dark, I remember turning around and looking at my father, who was a World War II veteran, and he was so proud and so happy, I think, for America in that moment. I think he realized what that would mean for our future. And I do hope that we do start spending a lot more money on space and on science. I'm all for it.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Roger, that highlights something. This people had a sense that this was a historic moment. This was a wake up the kids to watch TV moment.
No question about that. It was remarkable. Those who were alive at the time, and I'm a child of Apollo. We all sort of paused, if only for a short period of time, to take all of this in and to participate in it vicariously and to really be excited about it. And it really didn't matter where you were or what your background was. This was one of those great experiences in human history. And a lot of the things that we remember that are such big events in our lives, they're usually negative events. I mean, everybody knows where they were at the time of the 9/11 attacks and how they heard about that. But that's a horrible story. This is a great story, one in which we really can take pride in.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Phil now in Lake Mills. Phil, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Phil?
Well, at that time in 1969, a lot of us were much more concerned about the young Americans dying in Vietnam than we were about the Apollo program. And the U.S. space program had been beset by many disasters in the 1960s.
Phil, thanks a lot for the call. And there was a lot going on in the late 60s, Roger, than just the moon landing. How did this event stack up against this backdrop of the Vietnam War, social unrest, rioting in American cities across the country?
Yeah, you know, there's no question that the latter 1960s especially were tumultuous times in the United States. And you've got, you know, the Civil Rights Crusade that is in full bloom, but then violence associated with that, with the assassinations of Martin Luther King and others. And obviously the war in Vietnam and the divisive nature of that. And how that affected us as a people. And those are stories that are absolutely significant, and we can't not minimize how important they truly are. What is remarkable, though, about the moon landings is that although there were those who thought the money could have been better spent elsewhere, virtually everybody was willing to step up at the point that the actual flight of Apollo 11 took place and said, you know, this is something that we should be proud of.
Thanks for the call, Phil. We're talking to Roger Lanius about his new book, Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. Roger, you write about how the moon landing became a metaphor for us in a lot of ways. The line, if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we blank, or we need a moonshot effort to do whatever. How did this shape the way we think about tackling big projects?
Well, it changed the nature of this. I mean, one of the things we did learn, and it's a true statement, that, you know, if whatever we sort of set our mind to, that, well, I shouldn't say sort of, do set our mind to, we can make real inroads toward resolving those challenges. And the moon landings helped demonstrate that that was possible. With enough concerted effort, enough brain power, enough resources behind it, we could really change the world. And we've demonstrated that over and over again since.
On the other hand, you write that in some ways this was not a sustainable project. It ended just a few years later, and then we stopped the Apollo program, went on to the space shuttle eventually, but it didn't really open the door to wider human exploration beyond orbit.
No, not in terms of space flight. There's no question that the end result of that were the lunar landings, and that was because of the political nature of what we were doing and why we were doing it. Because of the Cold War objective that was a part of it. And we haven't had anything approaching that since that time in which the right answer to some problem is to undertake a lunar base or a mission to Mars or whatever it happens to be. So we'll have to wait for that in the future.
You also devote a chapter to conspiracy theories, moon landing denialism. When did this start?
Almost immediately. You know, the science, the chief science correspondent for the New York Times wrote a story at the time of the moon landings in which he said he walked into a bar in Chicago and there were a bunch of barflies sitting there while the flight's taking place, and they're spouting off about how, oh, these guys, you know, they can fake anything in Hollywood. You know, they're just doing this on a soundstage. So, you know, it's present from the very beginning. It really got a voice in a pretty fundamental way in the internet age, where anybody can put anything they want online and there's not any barriers to entry for them.
What is the appeal of moon landing denialism, if that's the phrase for that particular genre of conspiracy theory?
Yeah, that's as good a phrase as any. Probably the fundamental thing about it is that it's sort of a juxtaposition of a distrust of government and authority on one side and a sense that in a statement that I know something you don't know and here's the secret. And I think those are sort of the drivers that push people to say things about it. Those that believe it, some of them are probably a little less sophisticated from a technical perspective than others. Might be, and they just don't understand the nature of how you could possibly do this. But that's sort of the key drivers, I think.
That reminds me of a kind of a funny story about the flag planting. Denialists say, oh, look, it looks like the flag is flapping in the wind. There's no wind on the moon. Why is the flag all bent out of shape in that famous picture?
Yeah, it's a pretty simple task. A pretty simple reason. One is they had a telescoping rod that had to be pulled out to the side for the flag to hang on, since there's no air on the moon and no breeze to blow it. And they bent that telescoping rod the first time that they tried to put it out, and so it sort of hung down and looks like it's sort of flapping in that particular context.
And it became a tradition for the few years of moon landings. Other astronauts tried to replicate that look?
Yeah, they liked it, and they thought, well, yeah, okay, let's do that too. So they would end up, they would bend it intentionally.
Now, there's talk on and off in American history since then of what the next big thing is going to be for space exploration, publicly funded, privately funded, moon, Mars, whatever, humans on it, not humans on it. What are you watching for as our space program moves into the future?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we're going to see moving forward, and probably, you know, who knows exactly what the timeline is going to be for this, but I think we will see a continuation of the international consortium that is taking on the International Space Station today and is operating it. We will probably see that continue at some level with, I would say, an international group that will undertake a moon landing sometime. Hopefully in the next decade or so.
Are we able to plan long-term enough? Because it seems like, you know, this was this 7-8 year effort from announcement to completion. And it seems like with changes of administration, changes in Congress, our goalposts keep shifting. Do we have the capacity to say we're going to commit to something for the decade or decades it takes to accomplish it?
No question it's hard to do, but it can be done. You know, when, yes, the Apollo program lasted only a short period of time, you know, but about a decade. But the space station program has been operating since the early 1980s, and it's still operational today. So we can sustain things over a long period of time.
Roger, a lot of people, I think, were inspired by the Apollo program to pursue sciences or engineering or related issues. Did the moon landing inspire your choice of a career that brought you to NASA as their chief historian?
Well, I mean, maybe yes and no. I was jazzed by the Apollo program, and I was going to become a science major, and I tried that, but I couldn't handle the math, so I opted for history, but. Be that as it may, I did find my way to work in one of the greatest organizations ever established, one committed to doing really cool, important things for all of humanity.
Roger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Roger Lanius, former chief historian at NASA. He's with us today as we approach the 50th anniversary of the moon landing this weekend to talk about his book, Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. A federal watchdog released its first report on hospice care in the United States last week, and it had some troubling findings. More than 80% of the hospice facilities surveyed had at least one deficiency. That includes things like poor care planning or mismanagement of aid services. And close to 20% had what was called a serious deficiency that the agency said could jeopardize the health and safety of patients. Jean Erickson is a program assistant with the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups. She's previously a geriatric nurse for over 25 years. Jean, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here.
Before we dig into the results of this finding, some people I'm sure are very familiar with hospice, some less so. Could you just tell us what hospice does?
Absolutely. So hospice is considered an agency that provides care to terminally ill persons who have a life expectancy of 6 to 12 months. Now, this can be done in a person's home, or it can be done in another setting, such as an assisted living or a nursing home itself. A difference between palliative care and curative is really important to understand hospice. Palliative is treating symptoms and situations as they currently are present. Curative would be treatments that would try to cure a disease or an ailment.
Now, that takes us to this finding. Were you surprised by the number of facilities that had deficiencies and one in five or so had serious deficiencies?
Well, interesting, because I was reading it from the lens of a nurse. And so from geriatric nurse and going through audits on a yearly basis for over 25 years, that didn't surprise me. What concerned me was the number that had the conditional deficiencies, which are more serious.
So it might be, in many of these cases, this is we didn't meet the bureaucratic requirements for some of these lesser deficiencies?
It could very well be. And you listed some of the reasons why there were deficiencies. And how I was reading that is I was taking a little step back and thinking about what are the situations that may be in those treatment centers? Is there a shortage of staff? Is there other things that are happening, nurses working longer hours, that might have caused? Because a deficiency can be as simple as not signing off something. And so they can be very, very minor, but they're still there mm-hmm. no matter what.
And you mentioned conditional deficiency. Is that something that has you worried? What would that
look
like?
Well, a conditional deficiency is going to be something that is going to be more life-threatening and that could result in maybe that center or that facility actually having to close down temporarily to be able to get that justified. It could mean that a patient's life was put in more danger than what it is for the purpose that it is there.
Talking to Gene Erickson with the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups about a new report looking at hospice facilities around the country, finding a variety of deficiencies at many of those. Pulling even further back, Gene, what is the funding situation at hospice care facilities around the country? Do we have enough resources going into these to avoid these deficiencies in the first place?
Well, many of the facilities are going to be either just state-funded, which would be your Medicaid, with some Medicare supplementation, or they can be predominantly Medicare. There are some places that are private-funded, and those facilities were not the ones mm-hmm. that were listed in this survey.
Right. These are the ones that Medicare is connected to in some
Medicare
way.
And Medicaid were the agencies that they were looking at. It's safe to say, I believe the number was that they looked at 4,593 agencies, hospice agencies across the country. We have 85 in Wisconsin, but during the time of this study, only 73, which means maybe we had 8 new ones come in. So 73 were surveyed and were found to have deficiencies over at least one deficiency over that 5-year period. So numbers are, I think, a little bit low for hospice care, actually.
Is there enough staffing for hospice care? I've heard in a number of health professions, whether it's certified nurse assistants or different kinds of nursing, we don't have enough to go around. Is that this situation in hospice?
It is, actually. Hospice takes a very certain type of persons to be able to do it and stay with it and do it effectively and for the best for the patient. It's hard work, and it's a physical drain and it's emotional drain. Nursing right now is at a shortage. Nursing for the faster-paced hospitals, emergency rooms, surgical are finding an uptick right now of people that want to go into that field. End-of-life care, nursing home, which is definitely a much harder physical job, is not finding that. The other thing that we have going on is there's a lot of controversy and conversation about what are the proper training hours for example, certified nurses aides. So if somebody is not getting the right amount of hours that they need for training, they're not going to feel competent in what they are doing. They're going to feel overwhelmed. They're going to leave the field. And that, unfortunately, is what we're seeing happen.
Now, this is outside the scope of the national report, but from in your understanding, do we have enough hospice availability to meet the need here in Wisconsin?
Well, I was looking over all of the different agencies and the different counties that they actually do cover. We have 85 different hospice agencies that are actually operated by, I believe it's 68 agencies operate those 85. All of our counties are covered, and some of our counties have multiple agencies within them. I am looking that possibly in some of the more rural areas, there's going to be more of a shortage. In our bigger urban areas with the cities, there definitely seems to be enough facilities for care.
When it comes to quality and the deficiencies that you would view as important, ones we really need to address, what would be some of the ways we could tackle those and make sure our hospice is as good as it can be?
I think that one of the things that we can do is take a look at how are we promoting people going into different fields and what kind of a price, if we want to say that, and I don't mean dollars, I mean recognition that we give to people who are looking at different fields, such as end-of-life care. Instead of putting that as a secondary position, let's say that that's something that's really important. And for the families that are trying to make that decision of, do we put somebody into the hands of a hospice agency or do we find another means, it's important to have quality people that are going to be taking care of loved ones.
Now, what kind of stakeholders would need to take the lead on that and giving respect to end-of-life care as a profession?
From my opinion, it starts very much with those who are working with students. So you've got your social workers, your guidance counselors, really talking about nursing and what nursing might look like. And not just the fast-paced ones, but what it can be. Giving recognition to those who have been in the field for a while and allowing them to maybe come in and talk. The other stakeholders are your hospitals, your nursing homes, your skilled facility nursing homes, and your assisted livings. They have a big part in this. They can step up and make the job be important by improving the wages, improving the working conditions so people will want to come in. That will also help families who have to make this decision look at their facilities differently because they'll be able to see a quality.
Now, you went into geriatric nursing a few decades ago,
I guess.
I mean, was that, did people look at you and say, why are you going into that? Was that viewed as a weird decision in nursing?
Absolutely. Why would you possibly want to be doing that? Because there was the stigma about all that you would be doing is just taking care of the most basic of needs for those patients. That isn't what it is. But yes, it was a long time ago when I had started off as an emergency room nurse and went into nursing home.
Has that stigma changed at all since you went into the field?
A little bit, but not very much. It's still hard to get people to take a look at nursing home and want to stay in it and hospice care in that end-of-life stage as something that we really can make a career out of this.
Now, for families in a stage in their lives where they're thinking about hospice care for a loved one, what kind of things should they be weighing? What goes into that decision of whether to and then where to?
It's such a personal decision, and it's a very, very difficult decision. And sometimes you have family members who are on both sides, so they really have to try to come together. Now, the report said that there wasn't anything listed in the survey to be able to allow people to actually go in and check on deficiencies of the nursing of the facilities for hospice. That's not the case in Wisconsin. You can go onto the website of the Wisconsin Division of Health and you can search under hospice. You can come up with a full directory of all of the hospice agencies. You can search them by county and then you can search them by their surveys. I just pulled a random one up to see, it was the first one on the list, to see how it was done and how easy it is. If there is a deficiency, it will tell you exactly what the deficiency is. It will tell you if the plan of care was met. It will tell you the corrections outlined as they were done. So a family member living, say, up in northern Wisconsin has an opportunity to look at the site, look at the places, and then go in and see, is this someplace where we would like to have mom and dad or our loved ones?
And finally, some advice maybe for loved ones to advocate for their relative who's in hospice care to make sure that those important details don't get overlooked.
So the important thing with hospice is really being a part of the plan of care. And a family member should not be afraid or hesitant to ask about what is that plan of care that is for my mother or whoever the family member is. That's one of the areas of highest of deficiencies. Families have a right to have a part of that. They should ask about it. And if it's not being met, they should very definitely call them out on it.
Jean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Jean Erickson, program assistant with the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups, a former geriatric nurse. She was with us today to talk about hospice care after a federal report showed 20% of hospice facilities that receive Medicare funding had a deficiency serious enough that it could risk the health or safety of patients. At a campaign rally last night, President Trump continued to refer to a group of four first-term congresswomen as un-American and said they were free to leave the country if they didn't like it. All four women are U.S. citizens, three were born in the country. In response to Trump's mention of Representative Ilhan Omar, supporters began chanting, "Send her back." Here's a listen.
And obviously and importantly, Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
Calls for immigrants and minorities to return to their country of origin have a long history in the United States. Many different groups have faced similar rhetoric since our earliest years. Jennifer Wingard is an associate professor in the Department of English at the University of Houston, where she's researched the history of American political rhetoric. She's the author of the book Branded Bodies, Rhetoric and the neoliberal nation state. Jen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, well, you for having me. I appreciate it.
You found that this go back to where you came from language goes back a long way. Where do we first see this arise?
Well, go back to where we came from actually comes into policy around 1798, which is what, about 20 years after our first the country was first founded, with the Alien and Sedition Act. So there was some dissent around the government, and dissent, people were speaking out against this newly formed government. And to solidify an American presence, this act was put forward to allow people to be basically deported or sent away for treasonous or slanderous statements against the United States. Now, the caveat here is the context, because it's written around immigrants, because everybody was an immigrant back then. Nobody was a citizen of the U.S. because it was around the same time that they did the Naturalization Act, where we that we have now and that we follow, that people who were born here in this country, even if they were born to immigrants, were then citizens because the country was so new. So this kind of yoking dissent speech and immigration and sending somebody away who is dissenting against the country has been very much a part of U.S. nation building since its inception.
How have we seen it rise and fall, this idea, over the years?
Well, over the years, it has certainly risen and fallen because you have different waves in immigration and different kinds of acceptances of immigration. There have been key times in U.S. history where immigrants have been very lucrative for us. We have wanted the Bracero program in California and in Texas, where we were bringing immigrants from the Latin American countries to come help us harvest and work the fields and do work, so that we opened those borders up a bit during post-World War II. Now, that was a little strange because we brought in lots of people from Germany and from Eastern European countries. However, then you have to also remember the Japanese internment happened at the same time. So that was kind of a double-edged sword. And then you have other moments in history where we look for immigrants that actually have things that we want. Like, there was a period in time during the 80s and 90s that Canada was trying to fight the quote-unquote brain drain, because we were taking Canadians that had high skills and high education into the U.S., into our tech industry or our scientific industry. We were also taking people from India and from other kind Southeast Asian countries as well for that. So there have always been times where industry has really thrived on immigration, and for those reasons, we have been very pro-immigration. And then we're at a moment now where the middle class is really feeling that squeeze, that a lot of those kinds of middle class jobs are evaporating because we're turning toward more service sector jobs. So then again, this kind of notion of keeping immigrants out because they're going to take our jobs, and then Trump's other famous chant of build that wall comes into play.
Talking to Jennifer Wingard from the University of Houston, looking at the history of nativist rhetoric in the United States and President Trump's recent comments and the send her back chant at his rally this week. Jennifer, what do you make of that moment? Is this a turning point in some ways, the chant directed at an American citizen, a member of Congress, to be apparently sent back to her country of origin?
Well, it's certainly concerning. And what it represents is it represents the way that this rhetoric can be so slippery, that it can lose all of its historical and grounded material context and allow it to slide onto really inappropriate targets. It is the idea of send them back is a very anti-immigrant sentiment, but it is not a sentiment against people who have dissented, citizens who have dissented. If you think back to the Vietnam War, there was the slogan, love it or leave it. leaving it is a very different call than sending someone away. So that kind of turn, that's not parallel. That is a slide that is concerning because it's taking all of those markers of anti-immigrant sentiment and then shifting them over to people who are not immigrants at all.
Now, the president has said today he didn't like the chant. He said he cut in quickly to stop it, but it did go on about 13, 14 seconds. People timed it out before he resumed speaking. How central is this kind of appeal to the rhetoric you've seen from President Trump?
Well, I think that it is in line with a lot of the a lot of these rallies that President Trump has. If you think he has fostered a lot of different chanting, they all have the same kind of cadence: build that wall, lock her up, send her back. I don't know what it is, so that would need an ethnomusicologist to kind of get what that cadence does for people. But they all kind of have a very similar cadence, and that kind of festering and charging up the crowd with that kind of chant has been pretty consistent in the way he runs these rallies. So I do think that there is something about the show that he puts on at these rallies, that those chants, they engender those chants, they allow for them, whether he agrees with them or not. I don't know if that matters as much as that they continue to happen. What is concerning is kind of the Overton window. Is he shifting the discourse with these rallies and with these kinds of chants and fervors farther and farther to what we're seeing as acceptable in political rhetoric these days? And certainly the things that we were seeing before his campaign to now have definitely shifted. And this is another one of those bellwether moments, perhaps, that using anti-immigrant sentiment against a citizen of the U.S., if this is something that just kind of goes on, if we just go on from here and we just chalk it up to, oh, well, that's just what happens at a Trump rally, then we've all kind of accepted, again, a little bit more of a slide of what we see as acceptable in the political arena.
Long term, do you see this as a slide, or is this a pendulum? We've been here before. We'll swing back at some point.
You know, that is a very good question. And I think that there are a lot of people that are working on looking at Trump that liken his work to other fascist leaders. Not necessarily saying that Trump is a fascist, but there are some characteristics of his rhetoric, of his rallies, of some of the work that he is doing that have demagoguery and kind of keys of fascism in them. So it is possible, but I think what Trump has that these other leaders didn't is full access to social media, and he understands how to brand. So those little short chants, those little, I remember right after Trump was elected or right toward the end of his campaign, the New York Times published a whole list of all of the things he called all of the negative or derogatory remarks he had made in tweets about different people. And you noticed that certain people and certain things had the same moniker every time. That's a move toward branding. That's a move toward assigning a term to try and elide that kind of slide of meaning. So like Elizabeth Warren is always Pocahontas. Hillary Clinton was always crooked. Bernie Sanders was always goofy. Like there were always these terms that he would repetitively use to label people. And this is one of those moments.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Jennifer Wingard, Associate Professor of English at the University of Houston, where she's researched political rhetoric and immigration in American history, with us to talk about President Trump's calls this week for U.S. Congresswomen to leave the country. Have you ever looked at old photographs and wondered, why is nobody smiling? Why do they all look so serious? Smithsonian Magazine tackled that question in a recent Reader Mail column. I knew the answer already, except it turns out I was wrong. My wrong answer was this. It took so long to get an exposure back in the 1800s that it would have been painful to hold that smile for the camera for minutes at a time. Nope. Smithsonian Magazine took the question to Anne Schumard, senior curator of photographs at the National Portrait Gallery. She says in the mid-1800s that photo exposure would only last 5 to 15 seconds. Not so hard to hold a smile that long. So why so serious? In the 1800s, cameras were rare and photos were expensive. For many people, if you're having your photo taken, it might be the only one ever in your life. So people treated it like they were having their portrait painted, something serious. That was how they'd be remembered for the ages. They tried for a dignified, serious pose instead of a zany, lighthearted smile. And I say, let's bring that back. I am terrible at smiling for pictures. I just did a photo shoot, you know, for our website. I don't know, probably hundreds of pictures were taken. It only took, you know, a split second for each one. I'm really bad at smiling for cameras. I always like pictures where I'm, you know, serious or scowling or sneering or something. That probably says a lot about me. So I say, let's bring back the 19th century tradition, serious pictures forever. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.